If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? I'm your host, Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined on the other line by my good friend, Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Herring, live from a hotel room in Beacon Hill, Boston, Massachusetts, hours before Game 4 of the NBA Finals. Life could not be better. How are you doing on this fine Friday afternoon, Mr. Herring?
I'm good. Running on a little sleep, but I feel rested somehow. I don't know how. I'll probably hit me later before the game starts, but I'm good. No complaints.
Are you a nap person? Do you nap?
I'd like to say I'm not, but absolutely. I'm one of those nap people where maybe that was a sign that I need one, that I couldn't answer that one directly. I'm a person that likes to think that I could power through without needing one, but I generally do need them, even if it's just short. I take naps before I write stories, generally. I generally stay up late on Monday nights to write my newsletter, and I will, you know, for instance, I think earlier in this series, or maybe the last round, there was a game on a Monday night something, and I watched the game. I was like, okay, I'm going to bed right after this game is over. Then I'm going to sit down. I'm going to wake up really early at like 3 in the morning. So I treat sleep as a nap, cram, watch the game back, and then like take notes and write my newsletter after that. I do that a lot. I do that.
Wow.
I write overnight a lot of times. It's kind of a weird sort of nocturnal thing, but I like naps. I think they can be productive and get you over the line a lot of the time.
So I wish I was
I don't
a nap
take
person
naps
sometimes.
During the day as much.
Okay. That's, yeah. I have,
you never, should be.
I've never even heard of this phenomenon, the night nap. That's new to me, but if it works for you.
It's probably not healthy. And I honestly need to get away from it. I don't know. Maybe it's a procrastination sort of thing, but I feel like I work better when social media and everything else are like quiet and the news cycle's quiet. So I think that's part of why I like doing it, but it does become essentially a night nap, which then turns into like, and Matt Wong will tell you this, Matt and Jarrell, when I turn in my newsletter, I'm like, okay, I'm going to sleep now. Bye. So it's like I sleep a couple hours that night and then get the rest of the sleep after I turn in my assignment. So I guess I do take naps. Generally, if I'm napping, it's normally on Tuesday morning because that's when I've turned in my newsletter. Anyway, more information.
Chris Herring, nap 14 hours a day is basically what I got from that
hyperbaric chamber.
That answer, exactly. Congratulations to you. On today's show, we will be opening up the mailbag. We'll be diving into some finals talk and more. But first, a quick reminder to please keep your emails coming. Openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. All right, Chris. So tonight is game four of the NBA Finals. I want to zoom out a tiny bit and talk about this series on the whole by answering a few questions that I put in our outline. Real quick, before we get into it, here's a question I did not put in the outline that I have to ask just because it makes a lot of sense to start a podcast. What did Chris Herring think about game three of the NBA Finals, be it the fans chanting at Draymond, Steph Curry's ridiculous pull-up threes over drop coverage, Steph Curry's foot injury, Klay Thompson catching fire, Rob Williams looking like Rob Williams for the first time in weeks, or just something else entirely? Just what were your, some of your thoughts watching that game?
No, I mean, the Rob Williams part of it was massive. It just, the guy was everywhere. I mean, to be honest with you, so was Jaylen Brown when we're talking about shot blocking, although I know he did get called for a foul with one of them, which was a foul, but it was a pretty block anyway. But Rob Williams, that's it's weird because the drop coverage has been getting Boston in trouble in this series as it relates to Curry, but I do still feel like there's a fear factor as it relates to challenging Rob Williams, who isn't always even in the play and still makes some of these ridiculous blocks. So he's been a game changer, and him being healthy has been a game changer. I think now people are seeing why, when he had the injury at the end of the year and the surgery at the end of the year, why people were saying this might take Boston out of contention if he can't get back. Because the difference, even in this series, I think when he's fully healthy and really rearing to go, is just a night and day difference. He's a productive player anyway, but he's just terrifying when he can play the way he did in game three. So that was the big thing. And then Steph, just watching him continue to kind of plow through and play this way, but watching him have to do it for stretches by himself still. Klay stepped up, but I think now we're seeing, even when Steph gets that sort of support from somebody else, it still may not be enough. So that stood out to me a lot, and I think kind of speaks to, you know, where have you gone, Jordan Poole, a little bit, quite frankly. But so all those things stood out. The Boston defense was, aside from the drops, really, was really, really good, I thought, for the most part. It feels like they're really stubborn with that and really slow to pick that up. But aside from that, watching them defend in the series, at least in that game, was kind of a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, I think we'll get into some of this stuff definitely throughout our conversation today. The drop coverage is it's interesting because so much of what makes Steph great is the off-ball movement and the catch-and-shoot threes. And if you take those away and you give the pull-ups off the pick-and-roll, I guess the bet is that he won't make like 50% of them. They're hard shots. He's also Steph Curry. So it's kind of like, I get the logic on one hand. And on the other hand, I'm like, especially if you execute it well with, like, you know, Horford's trying to contest. You've got either Smart or Tatum or Derek White, who's done a really good job rear contesting. And this guy's just hitting, I mean, he's the greatest shooter who ever lived, so he's hitting shots that would validate that claim. Can he do that for an entire playoff series? That's the question. And so I understand why Boston is trying to take everything else away, but it's a fascinating chess match. Just that one individual, the pick and roll coverage, is interesting. So, speaking of, I guess, surprises, what has surprised you watching this series on the whole? I know we just kind of talked about the pick and roll coverage.
Sure.
I have a few answers here. Do you want to go first? Do you want me to let me tell you what I think? Or how do you want to do this?
Why don't you give me one of yours? I'll give you the one. One of mine was that Boston is still kind of, I won't say daring because I don't think it's always intentional, but it kind of looks like they're daring Steph to make some of these shots, which is Like you said, are they going to do that the whole series? Do they think that Steph at some point will go cold? So that was one of them. So I've already laid that one out. Why don't you give me one of yours, then I'll give you my other one after you give me one of yours. And then you can give me the rest of yours.
Sure. So I guess on an individual level, I don't think any individual player has surprised me that much. I think that Jason Tatum's inefficiency and the fact that Boston has kind of survived that to be up 2-1 is telling. The one player I think who, look, I thought heading into the series that this was not a matchup for Draymond Green offensively. So his struggles there do not surprise me. It's kind of other areas of the game that are like his switch numbers on ball, not good. Jaylen Brown has dusted him a few times. That matchup, I don't think there were moments in game two for sure where that was favorable to the Warriors, but on the whole, I don't think that's working out in their favor. Derek White had an and-one finish at the rim on Draymond on a switch at the near the end of the second quarter, I think, or maybe the third quarter, I can't remember, of game three. And it's just like Draymond, the playmaking isn't there because they're starting with Tatum. As we said before the series started, they were going to put Tatum on him, not Horford. So you can switch any pick and roll with Draymond and Steph. And when they're small, they put Smart on him. Smart and Tatum are happy to help off of Draymond when he's not involved in the play. When he posts up, he can't score. And the Celtics are so versatile defensively that they can just switch everything off the ball. And it just takes away what has made him so good for so many years. This is just not the matchup for him. I don't know how you adjust from that. He can't shoot. If he does shoot, that's fine.
It's fire away. You want that.
So I don't know.
I'm still not over that joke from the last podcast.
He's winning the press conference, I think. Like, I'll say that. Shout out to Draymond in that. Like, he's great. Man. He's insightful. He's entertaining. but on the court, I didn't expect him to kind of wither overall as he has, I'd say.
Okay. So I think part of what you are getting into when you talk about Draymond and what makes him so great, it's his instincts. It's his ability to take advantage of how much attention you've got to pay to Steph and Clay and Poole and everybody else. And obviously before Poole's even there, Draymond was good at taking advantage of those things. Where he has not always excelled and where it's been difficult for him sometimes, and I think this is kind of a microcosm of the series a little bit, is the athleticism difference is just a lot different between Boston and Golden State. We did see Golden State struggle with that a little bit in the Memphis series, too. I think it's part of the reason that Memphis was able to hold their own for a long period of time in that series, win a couple games in that series, why Ja Morant is still eating. You know, it's like a Thanksgiving feast he had in that series before he got hurt. The bodies on that Golden State team are not the most athletic, and some of the ones that are tied to the bench. Kuminga is a good example of that. So Boston has them beat in that regard, and it has not been particularly close. It's also that Boston hustles as much as really any team you're going to see. It was really interesting to me, by the way, that the whole play with Steph Curry where everybody's on the floor, that Steph Curry would have his foot hurt again in a game against Boston where this time it was Al Horford, where before the accusations about Marcus Smart, is he dirty? Was it a stupid play to make that? No, it's a hard-nosed play, and it's not surprising to me that it happened again against Boston. By the way, it probably should have been called a jump ball before we had that whole scrum. But anyway,
agreed.
But what I would say, aside from the athleticism jumping out, and it maybe not a massive surprise, and the fact that Boston has more and better two-way players than Golden State does, which is standing out a lot, the imbalance of the third quarters has just been like, we know Golden State is a great third quarter team. We know that Boston fans really dread the idea of third quarters coming around. Still, even with those two thoughts being true at the same time, the idea that we would have three third quarters in a row that would start the series where it's just double-digit victories for Golden State, And if you told me that, I would have assumed the Golden State would be up at least 2-1, you know, with the way that they've dominated the start of each second half. So obviously it's a thing. I don't think you can look at it and say it's not a thing, you know, with how dominant Golden State has looked at times. They obviously took the lead in the third this time, this past game, although it was not quite as dominant as the other two. But that's what stood out to me. It just it's like kind of jarring to watch a championship level team get beaten like that in three third quarters in a row.
Yeah, Ime Udoka talked about the third quarter of game three, which the Celtics started that the first 3 minutes of that quarter, the Celtics came out with punch, with force. They were moving through their offensive stuff like the game had just started. And then Steph Curry just kind of was like, I'm saying goodnight to this. And there was the 7-point play. And I was sitting next to my...
crazy.
I was sitting next to our colleague, Chris Mannix. And he was just like, he was apoplectic. It was good stuff. We were like, how many points did they just score? Like, what is the score right now?
7-point possession. That was insane. Like... That still is crazy to me because I'm – anyway, that was crazy to watch. Like, I watched the game over again and still had that thought in mind. Like, I can't remember how many times I've seen 7-point possessions ever. Something crazy to see.
Yeah, it doesn't happen often. The stat that I want to bring up that has really intrigued me so far is – Boston's assist rate, 73.3% during the regular season. You wrote about this. You hit this on the head. But during the regular season, their assist rate was 60.9, which is an okay number. I just thought that there would be a little more one-on-one in this series offensively from the Boston Celtics. I thought that the Warriors would switch a little bit more and, you know, a little bit more like ISO scoring opportunities as opposed to the drive and kicks that we've seen. And they've kind of bogged Tatum a little bit down in spots, particularly in the second half of game three where, you know, I think he took two or three elbow fadeaways, which is a shot that used to be in his bag, and he's kind of gotten rid of it as he's matured offensively. I expected just more of those shots in this series from them. I expected more pull-ups from Jaylen Brown. Those two guys, to their credit, have drawn two, made the right pass, sniffed the help out early with good spacing. That's something that they've talked about ad nauseum yesterday in their practice media availability. Cutting down the turnovers. So that assist rate, like, that's pretty telling. And to have a higher assist rate than the Golden State Warriors, like, I thought the Warriors' assist rate would drop because the Celtics switch everything, or switch a lot. And So I'm just a little bit surprised by that. And being more selfless, I guess, like, it's not necessarily a fair thing to say, but just sharing the ball a little bit more because of how you're defended. I didn't expect the Celtics to do that more than the Warriors. So that's surprised me so far, and that could obviously turn, but so far that's held.
Yeah, no, it's been a huge factor. I think Jeff Van Gundy kept pointing it out that he, you know, regardless of what you've thought about Tatum and his shooting, which obviously has not been great throughout the series, or at least not, you know, for the longest stretches, the passing has been there, the playmaking has been there, the assist to turnover ratio has been great for him as the primary ball handler. And then if you look at Brown, what Van Gundy kept pointing out was that how quickly he was making decisions, and that was standing out a lot in game three. When you mix how hot he's been starting these games out as, along with the fact that he's been a willing, eager passer early in the play, not after he gets bogged down and in trouble, not after they're able to bring that second helper, not after he's at the rim and kind of locked out with no opportunity to do anything with the ball. He's been a really, really good passer in this series. And I think when you take both him and Tatum and kind of make them the sort of playmakers they've been, you know, it helps explain how they can survive this series and win this series with Tatum maybe not having standout performances every single game. And so, it's again, there are certain aspects of the series where if you take them out and you look at them, you're like, how is Golden State not winning? The third quarters, Steph playing this well. Obviously, there are other factors that explain why Golden State's not winning the series. But I think if you were to say that Golden State's passing would be as good as it's been, and you mix that with Robert Williams looking the way he's looked, Derek White looking the way he's looked, it makes sense. Like, it makes sense that we are where we are. Some of the questions we had going into the series about how much Poole would show up, how big the stage would be for him, how Boston would look as far as defending all these guys. We're at the place where I think we probably should be series-wise. It makes sense.
Are you surprised at all at the success that Boston's defense has had in the half court guarding Golden State's offense? That was like kind of the heavyweight prize fight, Tyson versus Ali. I honestly thought it would be more of a draw, and when the game gets bogged down, as good as Boston's been, Golden State is they're Golden State. Like, come on.
Right.
Has that surprised you at all?
A little bit. Just a little. Not a ton, because if there was one team that had the ability to do that, it probably was going to be a team like Boston. We said that on our previous podcast. I think back to it, as much as I brag about, like, oh, well, let's keep in mind the one guy that kept saying that Giannis was the best player in the world before the season even started. I've said that so many times. I've never once acknowledged that you started sounding the alarm. I don't know which pod it was, but we were maybe in January still, maybe February. But you were like, one of our podcasts basically started with the question, like, are we sleeping on Boston? Can they win a title this year? Should they be considered the favorites? And it was well before they became the one seed that you asked the question. Obviously, you focus on them a lot anyway. But I was like, we got to wait and see. They've been playing well as of late, but, you know, not everybody's full strength yet, blah, 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 blah. Brooklyn, Milwaukee, blah, 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 Miami. You know, they've been really, really great for a while, and their defense was the impetus of that. Obviously they ironed out a lot on offense too, but they've been really good, and they've been, even before they had everything figured out, they had the switchability to make things challenging for Golden State. So it doesn't surprise me that they're doing that. Again, the Poole part of it is a little bit of a surprise. If you told me that he was going to struggle a little bit in the series, that's one thing. He really has had one decent stretch between a third and a fourth quarter in this series where he looked really good. That's really been it. Like, other than that, he's just been a guy. He had a really nice move in this last game on Robert Williams that was like, oh, God, that was beautiful. But if you can limit him to something like that, you take it in a heartbeat. And you've had enough other guys on Boston's team that have clearly outplayed him. So, it's a little bit surprising. Yeah, a little bit, not completely, but it definitely is a little bit surprising.
So my next question for you was, who is the most disappointing player in these finals so far? I already talked about Draymond, and I don't even know if I would call him necessarily. I guess it's fair to say he's disappointing. I'm not going to lie. Yeah, if you foul out with four rebounds, yeah, that's disappointing. So
yeah. Can I ask you one thing?
Sure.
Did you think people were overhyping how impactful he was in game two?
Yes.
Okay.
I did feel that way. I also thought that people blaming him for the three-point shooting in game one was incorrect, because he took away so much stuff at the rim, and that's what he wants to do.
People have a hard time just defining what he is and how good he is for this reason, because, like, we can't even agree on
when
he has
like
a good
him.
Game versus Beckham. Now, he did not play. There really isn't, at least not at a star level, where, like, someone that we all look at and say, this is a star. I've written before that, like, he's a star within what they do and what he's asked to do, hands down. If you put him on the Orlando Magic, not trying to down y'all, because I like Orlando, fun team this past year. I actually like watching them play. But, like, it probably looks a little different depending on who he's playing with. If he's playing with a team that doesn't have much spacing, for instance, like, it's not going to work. Sometimes when he's playing with Kevon Looney and with Peyton, like, it might look a little cramped. But he's been it's okay to say he's been disappointing. Like, his job is to be a defensive enforcer, not enforcer, but stopper, within what he's asked to do, with the help stuff that he's doing, with the quarterbacking that he's doing. But you do expect a little bit more out of him from a playmaking standpoint. You do expect a little bit more out of him from staying on the court standpoint. He's clearly been a little bit disappointing, at least. I'd put Poole ahead of him, though, just because you knew this was going to be a series where you had to score enough to be able to beat this team, who's going to hold you down a little bit. And look, he's a young guy, but there hasn't been, like, at least Clay had the one game where he really broke out now. So, it obviously would have been him if not for Poole, or if not for that one game. But I think Poole's the guy I would list here, even ahead of Draymond a little bit.
Poole is the other name that I have here. And again, it's kind of like, what were your expectations coming into the series to make it so that someone could be disappointing? And to be honest with you, he's played how I thought he would play in this series.
Let me see. What's he averaging so far in this series? Let me look. I'm looking up. Go ahead.
So he's averaging 12 per game. Shooting. The splits are, he's shooting 38.9%. 41%. Yeah. 41% from the floor. I think he's second in, he has the second highest usage on the team. His turnover rate is 24%, which is horrendous.
24 minutes a game so far, too. Now, granted, not every game has been close at the very end and everything, but yeah, I mean, it's also, that tells you that it's also a question of, like, can we have him on the court if he's not producing? Because the difference between him and Draymond is, like, Draymond, you know he's not going to give you a whole lot scoring-wise, but he's generally not hurting you. I mean, like, very rarely is Draymond Green, of all people, hurting you defensively. With Poole, obviously he can and he will hurt you defensively. So I don't know. Like, he's had two games where he's basically shot 50%, but it doesn't feel that way. Maybe it's just because the volume hasn't been there. And, you know, he's not averaging. He's, like you said, he's at 12. 12 points per game. You know, like, so you would expect a little bit more out of him, particularly in a series where Clay hasn't really had it going that often. Poole's the guy I would probably pick, just because if he's not giving you offense, like, you can't use him. He's not helpful.
Yeah, and really none of his impact has been in high leverage moments in this series. Like,
no.
His biggest shots really have come when game two is already decided. We talked about that after the game, after game two, but yeah, he continuously is looking. I think I said this on our last episode. I can't remember if it was with you or with Rohan. I apologize for confusing you with Rohan, but there was a play. I think it was in game one where Peyton Pritchard was guarding him, poked the ball away, and Poole just looked at the ref instead of trying to stay engaged in the possession.
I remember.
And last night, in game three, there was a play where, and I highlighted this in an article I wrote about Marcus Smart that you can go read on SI.com right now if you so please, where Smart is on Jordan Poole and he chases him. Looney sets a ball screen. Smart, like, I guess you could say he went under the screen, but he just basically went through the screen. It looks like I watched the replay like a million times in slow motion. He, like, teleports around Kevon Looney and is just in Jordan Poole's face. And Poole has a really quick release, but with Marcus Smart on his back or just trailing him, he, like, fumbles the ball a little bit and can't get the shot off. He has to throw it back to Clay, who misses a three. And as soon as he throws the pass back to Clay, or back to Looney, who then gave it to Clay, Poole just looks at the ref and he's like, "What's going?" And Marcus is in his face, shaking his head. And it's like, this is the finals. This is the finals. It's going to be physical. You're not going to get touch fouls. And if you can't live with it, then, like, it's just, if it's too hot, get out of the kitchen.
But that's the reality of what we're talking about here, is that Golden State is kind of the golden boy to some extent in this equation. They've been here before. Now, Jordan Poole hasn't, but the team has been here before. They've talked like they've been here before as far as Draymond saying, like, eh, these guys shoot this 50% from three. You just got to tip your cap. You know, like they haven't shot well a game or two before in the other series. Like, Al Horford hasn't had a career high in the playoffs before in this playoff run. Like, Derek White hasn't gone off for 23 before. So I understand it, but it's very much kind of like a – this is – it's almost like this unexplainable phenomenon that they shot so well in game one. Granted, the fourth quarter was ridiculous, but, like, generally speaking, that can happen. It's within Boston's capabilities to shoot that well. And then from the other standpoint of it, again, this is why Boston was a good matchup for Golden State, or maybe the most difficult matchup for them. They actually have enough bodies to throw at this team to where they can contain these guys one-on-one. Steph is the one exception, and they're struggling to contain that, but they aren't letting other people beat them. I mean, Klay was the closest thing we've seen to that last game. And, you know, if you're getting, what was it ultimately? 56 points out of those two? Close to 60 out of those two guys? I think Steph had 31, and what did Klay finish with, like 25, whatever it was? Like, okay, you would expect a game like that to be close to at least to be competitive. That's where Poole has to be better. Because other than those two, I'm not sure who you're expecting scoring from. Like, consistently expecting from. And shout out to Howard Beck for having written that piece about the fact that, like, there's no consistent second scorer here that you can, like, absolutely depend on. Klay has always been that guy. Well, maybe not always. Durant obviously was a guy that could have been your number one or your number two scorer. Klay has been that guy in the past, but obviously coming off catastrophic injuries, coming back for the first time in a couple of years, you can't expect that of him. He's not consistent enough to do that yet. Okay. Poole has been the guy that has filled that gap in these playoffs. Okay, this is a different sort of challenge. And they're used to having a ton of spacing to do what they do. And there's still some of it, but there are moments where there was one possession, it might have been the one you were just talking about, that was just ugly, where you look, some, particularly when Steph's not on the court, where it's like you got three guys clumped together on the wing trying to pass the ball to each other because they've got nowhere to go with it. They look a mess, and Poole looks flustered, and generally when you're flustered, your reaction is going to be, help! Help me! Like, to your teammates, to the refs, to whoever will listen, your reaction is going to be to complain about the crowd, which who gives a damn what the crowd is saying? I mean, someone, was it our friend Worldwide Wob who tweeted the video of a Golden State fan calling LeBron very much so out of his name? Granted, it was not a stadium-wide chant, but it was wildly disrespectful. And kind of, you know, like, to me, that's almost more disrespectful to yell it at the man 5 feet away from him than it is to have a stadium-wide chant. That happens at every level in every sport. Maybe not every stadium, but it happens at the pro level. We know that. So I was actually surprised by that, if we're going to keep it a buck about things that have surprised us, that we're making an issue of the crowd. Like, how bothered is Golden State right now that we're talking about this? Who cares? Like, why do you care? Just go win the game. Play a competitive game. And I feel like they are doing that. They're trying to do that. Klay had his best game of the series. They still lost somewhat handily. And now it's like it's turning into conversations about all these other things, because this is a team that actually can and I think probably will beat them at this point. And there's no way to come to grips with that other than to talk about ancillary stuff is kind of how it feels to me. I don't know. Who knows? They'll probably tie the series tonight, but it just kind of feels like there's something off here about this team, and I think a lot of it is that they don't have a second answer behind Steph consistently, like Howard was saying.
I was sitting in the front row when all of the Warriors were asked about the crowd, and I was like kind of surprised by all of their answers except Steph, who was like, it's par for the course. This is what, like, you know, we right. hear this stuff. It's like, who cares? Which is how you're supposed to kind of answer that. It's like, but whatever. One player we haven't really touched upon is Andrew Wiggins. And I'm getting, first of all, I think that I thought coming into this series, he was going to be absolutely critical for them. Needed to play defensively, yeah, like he played against the Mavs and Luka. has not done that really against Tatum and Jaylen. Offensively, they've treated him. I'm getting shades. I haven't heard anyone say this, but I'm getting shades of 2016 Harrison Barnes with the way the Celtics are treating him defensively, and he's not hitting the shots. So,
yeah,
like if you're Wiggins, you need to crash the offensive glass. You need to, when they are switching and it's late clock, you have to create your own shot and hit a tough shot. And when you're wide open in the corners, got to hit those threes. That's his role in this series. It's tough. He's like maybe their best. Well, he is their best perimeter defender, I would say. And it feels like they need to clone two or three Andrew Wiggins and have that Andrew Wiggins shoot 40% behind the three-point line to win the series sometimes. But he hasn't. He just hasn't looked as good as they need him to on either end, and I think that that is low-key, like, one of the most critical, like, parts of this series so far.
No, you're right, and it's funny. It's so, I think everything from the way his career has largely played out to, like, his demeanor, it's so easy to just forget about the dude. Like, literally.
I always forget he's on the team. He's on the team.
He's only got a max contract playing for, you know, a team that has been one of the favorites for the whole season. You know, like, it's just so easy, though, within the realm of how vocal and loud Draymond is, how amazing Steph is, how capable Klay is, you know, if he gets it going, how great Poole has been all year, how great Looney is in moments with the offensive rebounding and the dump-off passes to him. And then there's Wiggins, who you just, like, forget. But, yeah, the guy that, you know, in some ways won them the series in some regards last series, and has had moments here and there where it's like, I mean, he had a couple dunks last game. He's had a couple plays where he's made life a little bit difficult for Boston, you know, on the offensive end. But yeah, I mean, he is the one guy, I would say, unless Peyton really makes a big impact some way, or unless you decide to bring somebody like Kuminga out and roll him out for a series like this, which I don't really see happening. If you were to do something like that and they break out, the only guy that I feel like really shifts the balance here in some way, meaningful way, is Wiggins. He has that capability. And I think it speaks volumes about the fact that, you know, Boston's kind of that is a good way to put it. Like I forgot about that Harrison Barnes series. Man, fans were letting him have it. That was like the whole, we got to go get Durant sort of thing, where people were okay with unloading a guy that had been part of the core because they got so little out of Harrison Barnes. He was so quiet. He was Wiggins in some way, when you really think about it, as far as the demeanor, as far as the ability, as far as what people thought he could be when he got in the league. He was not a number one pick, so I don't think it was ultimately as disappointing to people. But also, he started his career with Golden State, so you got a chance to watch him be a part of winning early on, where Wiggins didn't have that reputation. But that's a really actually like apt comparison, I think, to compare those two in the way they're being played in the series or game planned in the series. It's very interesting.
So this kind of leads us into another question that I had for you, Chris, which was basically like, what is your favorite five-man lineup for each team? Mm-hmm. And for the Celtics, there's a couple answers. I think the Celtics are a little more, like, it's just a straightforward question with them. Really easy to answer. You like them big, you like them small. A lot of that is honestly dependent on how the Warriors are playing and who is playing well on Boston. And right. That's how Ime reads it, and that's what makes him such a great coach. Like, Derek White was so critical in game one, and Ime isn't afraid to be like, hey, Derek White, you're not playing the last 15 minutes of game three because I wasn't really feeling what you were doing earlier.
Right.
And also, Rob Williams was playing great, and you kind of had to keep him on the court. But, like, so the Celtics are, we can get into them more specifically in a second, but the Warriors are far more interesting to me in terms of what is their best five right now. For you, what is that five, man? Like, let's say game four or game five or whatever, It's a you know, tie ball game with 5 minutes to go. Who is on the court for the Warriors, in your opinion? Or who should be on the court?
Well, it's funny because with that, it's like, are they ahead or are they behind? Because if you're behind, maybe you feel like you have to use Jordan Poole. If you're ahead, maybe you don't have to. And for all the reasons we just talked about, where you're trying to preserve a lead. If we're just looking at this series and the way it's played out and the comfort level that guys have had, I'm keeping Klay in my lineup. I think he does provide some value. At least the threat of him still provides some value. He still is a guy that cuts backdoor, that gives you a lot of options through that. So Klay's going to be out there for me. Curry is the obvious choice no matter who you're talking about. I would prefer the version of Curry whose ankle isn't messed up. Hopefully it's not. And then you mentioned Wiggins being probably their best on-ball guy. So Wiggins is there. I'm going to stick with Draymond, hoping that he's giving me something offensively and not in foul trouble on defense, obviously. But then I'm going to go with Otto Porter, who has been, I mean, really good, a really kind of flexible, okay, this gives us another shooter. He grabbed a really, really key offensive rebound in the last game and has been pretty active down there. He gives you size. He's a guy that can hold his own defensively and can take on different matchups defensively and can get involved in the screen game as well. So I'm going to go with that, again, with the idea that, like, at least from what we've seen so far, and I know that you're not going to boil everything down to just this series, but Poole needs to be playing well enough to justify a spot in a key lineup. You brought up the best point of all, which is that he really has not had game-changing plays in this series. He's more often done it, and people have made the front-running accusation of him and at times Steph, which I don't, whatever. But with Poole, I mean, it really has kind of...
We won't go there.
Yeah, I'm not... I don't want... Like I said before in a previous podcast, I don't want people finding my old tweets from however long ago. I don't have them to be found. But anyway... But Poole hasn't played better than Otto Porter in this series. Now, they're being asked to do different things, but Porter has been a better all-around, more impactful player in this series than Poole has. Porter has. So, I would go with that for now. I think it gives you more versatility. You're not going to be hunted as easily with the lineup like that. So, I'll roll with it.
I thought about Otto Porter. Seems like he's made every single shot that he's taken in this series. My issue with him, especially if you're small, which your lineup is defensively, he just hasn't held up. And I think that they would hunt, like Porter would be what Poole would be if he was in the game. I think that they've treated him like that a little bit, depending on who's on the court for the Celtics, particularly when the Celtics are small, like they will hunt him. So that's the reason why I personally don't have Porter in my lineup, but I can see
who'd
why
you
do.
You use Poole?
No, absolutely not.
you ain't got to laugh about it, though.
No, I don't.
Damn, bro.
So I have two, and I had a difficult time choosing between them, but there's one.
Okay.
I guess it's like who's going to be the center in these units. And
okay,
it's Curry, Klay, Wiggins, GP2, who...
That makes sense. And he was the last guy I thought about, too.
I was very curious as to why... I guess here's the deal. Like, if you're the Warriors, you don't have enough two-way players. That's your problem. So you need to balance that. You need to balance spacing with defense. And to me, I don't like how Boston's offensive rating is like what it was during the regular season in this series. If I'm Steve Kerr, like, I want to make them hurt on that end. So I need GP2 on the court. He's my second best defender and one of the best defenders in basketball. The question for me, honestly, is like Looney or Draymond. And I don't know if that's crazy.
Because you can't use them both, right? Like you can, but you're going to suffocate a little bit offensively. And I feel like you can justify it in the moments where Kevon Looney's playing like a madman with the offensive rebounding stuff. a little bit. And if Draymond is screening like a madman and defending like a madman, you can justify it a little bit more. But when you're struggling to get stops and you're struggling to get any sort of spacing, and you look up and you've basically got two guys who at times you use them as centers, obviously Looney all the time. Yeah. I mean, that was my one thing clearly is like, I'm not, their starting lineup would not be my favorite five, man. We knew that. Because you suffocate a little bit offensively. So I'm with you on that. Looney, but yeah, damn, Looney or Draymond. So it's not a clear-cut one for you.
I'm honestly leaning Looney, and the reason why is they just got pummeled on the glass. In like Grant Williams was having his way. Smart was crashing the offensive glass, to say nothing of obviously Rob Williams and Al Horford. So that would be... That's worrisome to me if I am Steve Kerr. So I'm like, yeah.
You're making me rethink my crap now. Because at the same time, as I talk about that, I guess my premise was that they're not athletic enough to win the series on it. Like they're better athletes on the other side. So if you go small, are you inviting more of that? The lineup I threw out there has been a +4 in 13 minutes, but that also could just be a function of if this lineup played at all during one of those third quarters, then of course they're going to have a positive. So who knows? It. Like I said, maybe it would depend a little bit on whether you're playing from ahead or behind, if you're talking about the last few minutes of something. But yeah, I mean, I don't think there are a whole lot of great answers here for Golden State, which they're not used to having to say that or think that or feel that. And to me, I do feel like there's a little bit of a correlation between that reality and the fact that there's so much conversation. Granted, they're answering the questions they're being asked, but as it relates to the crowd and the podcast, like, just focus on the game. You have enough to worry about with that. Who cares? I'm not used to hearing them sound so bothered by everything. This is a championship team.
Mm-hmm. Guess how many minutes that five-man unit that I just listed has played in the series?
The one with Looney and Peyton. I'm going to guess like 4 minutes, maybe.
It has not played in the series.
It has not played at all. Because you know what's funny? You mentioned it. I remember wanting to write my newsletter and wanting to start talking about how dominant they were in some of these minutes with Peyton and Porter. And I looked up. I'm like, they actually played like a minute or two or 3 minutes. But it seems so productive because those guys were doing such a good job. I would not have guessed that they played no minutes with Peyton and Looney. Obviously, yours was a five-man lineup. But, yeah, I mean, at a certain point, I trust Kerr to kind of just try a bunch of different things and not stick with them very long if they're not working, because this next game, I mean, tonight's game is essentially a do-or-die game. Obviously, Golden State knows that 3-1 is possible to come back from, for all the wrong reasons. But you just don't want to be in this hole. It's already asking enough, too, of Steph to play. I don't know if Steph would be playing this game if it wasn't a finals game, like if it wasn't a playoff game with them down 2-1.
He couldn't.
We'll see how he looks. But
he was asked that yesterday, and he was like, he laughed a little bit and was like, context is everything.
Yeah.
I don't know the specifics. Like, I can't answer that question.
I don't.
And it was like, no, I think you're right.
Right. You're resting him. If this is a regular season game, you're maybe you're resting him. If this is, I mean, if Golden State is up 3-0 so far, you're resting him. Like, I'm convinced of that. If they felt like they were going to win the series pretty much no matter what, you're resting him. If they were up 2-1, it's an interesting conversation, but down 2-1, you know he's going to play. This game means everything. And so it is one of those things where I expect to see some alterations from Golden State, but if they start to really struggle with something, even for just a minute or two, I imagine that Kerr will flip it really quickly because they just don't want to play around here and find themselves down 3-1.
All right, let's go to the mailbag now. We have an email from James who writes, Given that Steve Kerr and Ime Udoka are former role players, Kerr a three-point specialist who designed an offensive strategy around exploiting the efficiency of the three-point shot, and Udoka a gritty, do-everything journeyman who turned a finesse team described as soft into one that forces his superstar talents to do all the BS, who do you predict is the role player currently in his prime who will be the next-gen role player head coach in 10 to 15 years? Very fun question, James. Thank you so much for submitting it. I have five candidates here, Chris. How many do you have here?
I've got five on it, Michael.
Beautiful.
I got five on it. Sorry.
Do you want to? It's lovely singing voice. Do you want to drop one of your candidates in, and we'll get this conversation rolling?
Sure. Sure. I could start with. I will say this. I think that three of my five were too young for the age range that he listed, but whatever.
That's okay.
Alex Caruso was one of the first people that came to mind for me. He's played around star talent. He knows what it is to be a role player. He works really hard. He's well-liked by most people around the league, I think. I don't know if people dislike him. But, yeah, I think Caruso would make for an interesting guy in a role like that.
I like that one. That's a good choice. Very heady player, sacrificial player. Obviously has played point guard, which is basically a prerequisite to being a head coach in some ways, not always, but some ways. Yeah, so I like that one. Can I give you one of mine that actually...
Please.
I haven't seen his name floated in conversations like this, but I think he would do a really good job if that's a route he wanted to go down, and it's Patty Mills. And the reason why, a lot of it is, you know, I love guys who, for questions like this, who played for Pop and were around Pop. It just seems like something about him rubs off on really intelligent players, and they keep some of the habits that he instilled in them. I don't think it's a coincidence that Udoka and Kerr both come from the Pop tree, played for Pop.
I'm really mad I didn't think about Patty Mills. That's a great one. That's probably the best call. It's better than any call I've got on mine. Okay.
Okay, don't sell yourself short. But that he would just be really interesting. And I could see him, honestly, like, he's a no BS dude. He isn't afraid to call out guys. Has played with some of the best players in the world, won a title. So, yeah, Patty Mills. Who's your next one?
Mikal Bridges, too young, obviously, but another guy that just someone who seems really smart, plays around a couple of stars, excels on defense, which I kind of feel like if you have that to your game and you are someone that already understands that part of the game, maybe puts you a little bit ahead of the curve in some ways, plays for a guy that is respected by everybody. Another guy that I feel like could very easily go his whole career without being disliked by anybody, which I think matters as far as it relates to guys that become coaches. I think guys that just have really good league-wide reputation is part of the reason I picked Caruso. Just a smart, heady kind of player that is a star, but not in the way that we think about. And I think he's kind of right at that threshold of, like, most guys that become coaches are not superstar players. And I think he's not quite in that realm to where I think it will get difficult for him to get one, because I feel like everybody sees him do the dirty work and put in that kind of work to have the respect he has around the league.
I'm going to drop two on you.
Okay.
Because they're both in the finals. Mm. One is, and I don't think either will ever be a coach, but I would just love to see it. Andre Iguodala, who's like the quintessential role player of this era on the defining generational team. I don't know if he has the temperament to coach. I think he sees the game in a really interesting way, and whenever he talks about the game, it fascinates me.
Yes, 120% agreed.
Yeah, but I don't know if he can be a coach for some other. He's a little quirky. I don't think he would want to do it.
I think he almost speaks too bluntly. Like he and I have podcasted before together. He actually had me on his podcast like a month and a half ago, which was really cool. And he and I were talking about how he holds back his true feelings with the media because he doesn't always trust the media. But then when he, in the moments where he doesn't, like he's so real that it like, it gets him in trouble or people question him. So coaches generally can't be that way. I feel like they're criticized if they don't say enough. They're certainly criticized if they say too much. And part of me kind of feels like he would either, you know, I also think he likes the lane of being able to speak exactly what he's thinking, which generally scares people when coaches do that, unless you've accomplished everything there is to accomplish. So he would make a fascinating coach, though, and I think he'd be a really good assistant, which maybe would help him figure out whether he wanted to be a head coach at some point.
That's so interesting that you say that, because I asked him a question the other day, and he started, he grinned, grinned at me, paused for a minute, and then said, I don't think I can answer that without being politically incorrect.
Yep. He's fast. It's in his book, too. He explains that whole dichotomy of why he doesn't fully trust the media. He's an interesting, he's one of the two or three most interesting players in the league, just as far as the way he deals with the media and how smart. I think he's brilliant, honestly. But he would make a very interesting coach. I think he'd probably be a good coach. And I think he'd probably relate with his players very well, but the media part of it would maybe not be his favorite thing.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of it. Now, honestly, some of the people I have on my list, I put on the list because their media tendencies kind of strike me as they sound like a coach. I can give you my next one, actually.
Okay, where it's yeah,
like,
go ahead.
I can't pick out anything about his game that strikes me as like he's a coach, but the way he talks sounds like a coach. Kevin Huerter sounds like a coach. He talks, and like he has a little bit of a swagger and a belief in himself. It's not off-putting.
Very confident. Very confident.
Very confident, but it's not off-putting. But also, like, he's politically correct, but not always, but not in a way that would offend anybody. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, maybe that's not politically incorrect then, but just, like, I interviewed him a couple of times, and each time I walk away from him, I'm like, that dude sounds like a coach. He's really young. Again, like, there's not necessarily anything about his game that seems like it would absolutely translate. It's hard to pick up on those sorts of things about what would translate about a player aside from how smart they are. So I don't know if there's that to his game at all. He's too young. We'll see. But he the way he talks, he's got that part of it down already. I've got one more name after that too. Two more.
I like that pick. Well, we can zoom through these. My next one is I had Draymond. Just I don't even know.
Makes sense. Like, that makes sense.
I kind of like just want to speak it out there. I just want him to be in the. I guess he's going to be an analyst after he retires, not get into coaching. But
he wouldn't be the first one to make the jump from that to coaching, though. Obviously,
yeah. I wonder if the pull and the lure of competition will get him back into coaching at some point, or back into the league on sidelines at some point.
How That'd many be technicals nice. Would Draymond get as a coach?
Oh my, yeah, that would be, there's no preferential treatment for coaches. Yeah, there's no preferential treatment for coaches.
Right now. So, but as far as people that just know the game inside out and, I mean, he would be fascinating. He would be the most interesting coach in the league from that standpoint. You said you had five. How many have you given out so far?
Three.
Okay, so I've given you three. I've said Bridges, Huerter, and Caruso. I had Monte Morris on my list as a guy that I think could do the job.
Love it, love it, love it.
Just a guy that's very, very heady, guy that sees the game well. Obviously someone that's played with a superstar and has played with guys that are more talented than he is, but he's really, really good himself. And seems like he, you know, he kind of reminds me a little bit of like Mike Conley, where he's, I think he's pretty well liked. He doesn't really look out of character as far as the way he reacts to people on a team that sometimes looks really emotionally overwhelmed. I think Denver has moments like that where they just look out of sorts, and he doesn't really seem to get too high or too low in those moments. Maybe once I've seen him like that, but I like him a lot, and I just kind of feel like he has a demeanor, and he seems like a really smart guy.
Let me drop my last two on you at the same time. Mm-hmm. One is Thad Young. Just
I like that. I thought about him.
Smart, really smart dude. Really personable. I think everyone who plays with him loves him. Kind of a no-brainer option when we're just thinking about role players and guys who've been around the league for a long time. My last one, you know, he was rumored to actually be a potential Lakers head coach in this go-around before Darvin Ham was hired. And then a lot of off-the-court stuff that's really disturbing we don't need to get into, but it was Rajon Rondo. I don't know if he's... I think he is interested in being a coach at some point and might have to start in college, start as an assistant after he retires. But that's someone who I could totally see being a head coach in like 5, 6, 7 years in the league.
Yeah. You can't complete, and not that you did, but like you can't completely gloss over that stuff because that stuff was like eye-poppingly bad if it was true and if it actually happened. And, you know, I'll encourage people to look that up for themselves when they get a chance. It's interesting because for you to have mentioned Draymond in the last one and then mentioned Rondo, there absolutely was a lot of the same stuff as just far as how far Draymond pushes stuff and how Rondo has done that with his own coaches, including guys that are going to be in the Hall of Fame someday. So he would be interesting. I mean, He knows that he knows so much more than most people that he speaks to. Probably, in his opinion, yes. Everyone he speaks to. It would be interesting to see how that comes across in a coaching job. Because even as a point guard, he felt like he knew more than his coaches a lot of the time. So him running the show completely would be, wow, would be fascinating. My last name was not nearly as... glamorous as that one as far as just the name recognition. I mentioned Garrett Temple as my fifth one. Just a guy that's been around the league. You would not find, in my opinion, like a single person to say a bad thing about him. He's probably played for a third of the league at this point. Not trying to be funny. I think he's probably been on 10 teams so far. But always has a job waiting for him because not only has he been a decent, solid role player for a long time, or at least he was, but is just well respected and everybody thinks of him as a good dude. I think he had a role within the Players Association, I believe. So just kind of, you know, I don't know. You think of certain people around the league as maybe just having the demeanor and the respect around the league to get a shot. Probably would start on the bench as an assistant first if he wanted to. But, you know, could work his way up, and I could see it.
Perfect. Well, that was a fun question. Thank you so much, James, for writing in. Chris, I think we're going to get out of here. I think that'll do it for today's show. Thank you so much for your expertise, your insight. Thank you so much to our listeners for the wonderful emails. We'll get to a whole bunch more in our next show. Keep them coming, please. Openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Everybody stay safe. Everybody please continue to enjoy the NBA Finals. Whoa.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.